A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether inflation is actually a deliberate feature of a well-functioning economy, not some recurring accident. If prices are always trending up, that creates a race where salaries either keep pace or your real income shrinks. And his core question is, wouldn't it be better if the standard was neutral inflation, 0%, so ordinary savers aren't constantly losing ground? It's a question that feels almost obvious when you say it out loud. Why do we accept this? And honestly, if you got $10,000 in a savings account and you check what it buys today versus what it bought 20 years ago, the question kind of asks itself.
It's the number they picked on purpose, and they work every day to keep it there. The Federal Reserve explicitly states this in their monetary policy principles. They target 2% inflation as measured by the PCE price index. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee sets interest rates specifically to hit 2% CPI. This is not drift. This is design. So Daniel's question cuts right to the tension. Healthy for whom?
That's the thing. If your financial plan is put money in the bank and leave it alone, the system is designed to eat your lunch. But the people designing the system know that. They're not idiots, and they're not cartoon villains. Which sounds lovely when you imagine your grocery bill.
And that's the trap. Falling prices sound like a gift to consumers. But the mechanism is brutal. When prices fall across the board, people stop buying things. Why purchase a washing machine today if it'll be cheaper in 3 months? Multiply that across every household and every purchasing decision, and demand collapses. When demand collapses, businesses cut production. When they cut production, they cut jobs. When jobs disappear, people have even less money to spend, so demand falls further. Prices fall further. And you're in a spiral.
The thing that sounds like a saver's paradise becomes a recession accelerant.
Worse than a recession. The IMF's framework on this, from their Back to Basics series, is blunt. Moderate inflation is a buffer against exactly this. It gives central banks room to cut real interest rates during downturns without hitting what's called the zero lower bound. If inflation is already at zero and a recession hits, the central bank can't push real rates below zero easily. They're out of ammunition. But if inflation is sitting at 2%, they've got room to maneuver. They can cut nominal rates, make real rates negative, and stimulate borrowing and spending.
2% is basically the policy equivalent of keeping a spare tire in the trunk.
And the Japanese experience of the 1990s and 2000s is the cautionary tale everyone in monetary policy has burned into their brains. Japan hit a deflationary spiral after its asset bubble burst. Consumer prices fell for years. They entered what economists call a liquidity trap, where even zero interest rates couldn't stimulate demand because everyone was hoarding cash waiting for prices to drop further. It took decades to climb out. The behavioral economics literature on this is extensive. Workers perceive nominal wage cuts as deeply unfair, morale tanks, productivity collapses, so firms avoid it at almost any cost.
Which means wages only move one direction in normal times, up, even if it's slow.
So when central bankers hear, why not target zero, they hear, why not risk turning into 1990s Japan? This is the wage price spiral, and it creates a built-in upward drift. It's not a conspiracy, it's just the aggregate result of millions of individual decisions that each make sense in isolation. No single firm can break the cycle without getting punished by the market.
We've got this ratchet effect. Wages can't go down, so prices trend up. But that still doesn't explain why central banks actively target 2% instead of, say, zero. Why add fuel to a fire that's already burning?
But the deflation made every other problem harder to solve. When prices are falling, the real value of debt rises. A company that borrowed $1 million when prices were stable now owes $1 million in an environment where its revenues are shrinking because customers are paying less. The debt burden gets heavier even though the nominal amount hasn't changed. So deflation turns manageable debt loads into crushing ones. That's what happened across Japan's corporate sector.
The 2% inflation target is essentially a buffer. It gives central banks room to cut rates without hitting the floor.
With 2% inflation, the neutral interest rate, the rate that neither stimulates nor restrains the economy, sits around 2 to 3%. When a recession hits, the Fed can cut by several percentage points before reaching zero. And that mechanism isn't unique to Japan. Any economy with significant debt, which is every modern economy, becomes more fragile when prices start falling. Households with mortgages, students with loans, governments with bonds, outstanding. Everyone's debt gets heavier in real terms. It's like the economic gravity gets turned up. And we saw what happened even with that full range of cuts. They still needed quantitative easing, trillions in asset purchases, because zero wasn't low enough.
Then there's Japan.
It essentially originated with New Zealand in the late 1980s. Their central bank was the first to formally adopt an inflation target, and they picked 2% partly based on the analysis of the time and partly because it was a nice round number that wasn't zero. Other countries followed. But the economic logic that solidified it is real. At 0%, you're right up against the deflation danger zone. At 1%, you're still uncomfortably close. A modest shock tips you into deflation. 2% gives you a buffer. At 3 or 4%, you start getting into territory where inflation itself becomes disruptive. People start changing behavior to avoid holding cash. Menu costs become real, the tax code gets distorted. If you owe $200,000 on a mortgage and prices drop, you're now paying back that loan with dollars that are worth more than when you borrowed them. The debt burden grows in real terms, which sounds trivial, but at high inflation it's not. Think about a restaurant during a period of 10% inflation. They're not just reprinting once, they're reprinting every few months.
Fisher called it debt deflation, and it's the nightmare scenario that keeps central bankers up at night, because once you're in that spiral, monetary policy stops working. You can cut rates to zero, and it doesn't matter. Nobody wants to borrow when the real cost of repayment is rising.
The historical record on deflation is genuinely terrifying. The Great Depression saw prices fall by about 25%. Unemployment hit 25%. That's what economists call price uncertainty, and it degrades market efficiency. People make worse decisions, or they spend time and energy trying to figure out whether a price is fair that they could have spent on something productive. There's also something called the greasing the wheels argument. At 2% inflation, employers can deliver real wage cuts without cutting nominal wages. A worker who gets a 1% raise during 2% inflation has taken a real pay cut, but it doesn't feel like one. If inflation were zero, that same adjustment would require actually reducing someone's paycheck.
Zero inflation isn't a stable equilibrium. It's a knife's edge with deflation on one side, and the historical record says deflation is much worse than moderate inflation. That's the institutional argument. Inflation is partly a psychological lubricant. It lets the labor market adjust without anyone having to say the words, pay cut.
And the Bank of England's framework makes this explicit. By anchoring inflation expectations at 2%, they create a predictable environment where businesses and workers can make long-term contracts without wild uncertainty. The target itself becomes a coordination device. Everyone plans around 2%, and that very planning helps keep inflation near 2%. Part of it is quality improvement. A car today is vastly better than a car in 1990, but some of the price increase reflects that quality gain, not pure inflation. Expectations are everything in monetary policy. That's why the 2021 to 2023 inflation spike was so destabilizing. Central banks insisted for months that inflation was transitory, supply chain noise that would fade. They were wrong. By the time they acted, CPI in the UK hit 11.1% in October 2022. The Fed had to raise rates at the fastest pace in 40 years.
Which means we're closer to price stability than the headline number suggests. But even so, we're not at zero. And for someone with cash in the bank, the distinction between 1% erosion and 2% erosion is a matter of degree, not kind. That's the part where the theory meets reality. Because that aggressive rate hiking cycle hurt borrowers badly. Mortgage holders saw their payments double. Businesses faced collapsing credit.
And this is where we need to follow the money and ask who actually wins and loses. Because the simple story, inflation hurts savers, is true but incomplete. It hurts some savers and helps others.
Let's talk about the saver who's been getting crushed.
From 2000 to 2020, the average real return on U.S. savings accounts was negative, 1.2% annually after accounting for CPI inflation. That's two decades where cash in the bank guaranteed a loss of purchasing power. The uncomfortable answer is, it is tilted against ordinary savers, not maliciously, but structurally. Inflation is a regressive tax. It erodes the purchasing power of anyone holding cash or fixed income assets. If you've got $50,000 in a savings account earning 0.5% interest, and inflation is running at 2%, you're losing 1.5% of your purchasing power every year.
That's the experience Daniel's pointing to. Ordinary savers who followed the rules and got burned. So why do central bankers not see this as a policy failure?
Because they're looking at the whole balance sheet, not just the savings account. The S&P 500 has returned about 7% annually in real terms since 1926. Real estate has appreciated substantially over long horizons. The problem isn't that inflation destroys all wealth, it's that inflation destroys cash wealth while inflating asset wealth. And asset ownership is wildly unequal. $7,000 vanished. And that's assuming headline CPI actually reflects your costs, which brings us to the next problem. So inflation acts as a regressive transfer mechanism. It quietly moves purchasing power from cash holders to asset holders.
That's the hidden transfer. And it's not a bug in the system, it's a feature that nobody campaigns on because nobody would vote for it if you described it plainly. We're going to gradually transfer wealth from your savings account to people who own stocks and real estate. Not exactly a winning slogan.
Here's where the picture gets more complicated, and I want to be fair to the full data, because they spend a larger share of their income on necessities. Housing, food, energy, transportation, and those categories have tended to rise faster than the overall price level. Meanwhile, the things that have gotten cheaper, consumer electronics, flat-screen TVs, are discretionary purchases that make up a smaller share of their budget. So the basket of goods that determines your personal inflation rate looks very different depending on where you sit on the income ladder.
The problem isn't inflation per se. It's that something broke in the wage-setting mechanism around 1973. Productivity kept rising, but wages stopped tracking it.
The Economic Policy Institute has documented this extensively. From 1948 to 1973, productivity grew about 97% and hourly compensation grew about 91%. They moved together. Anyone holding fixed-rate debt. If you've got a 30-year fixed mortgage at 3% and inflation runs at 2%, you're paying back the bank with dollars that are worth less every year. The real value of your debt is shrinking. Governments love this too. Inflation erodes the real value of national debt. It's a silent, deleveraging mechanism.
Then there's the asset price channel.
This is where the inequality story really sharpens. Low interest rates and steady inflation inflate asset prices. Stocks, real estate, fine art, cryptocurrency, assets that are disproportionately owned by wealthier households. From 2020 to 2022, U.S. home prices rose over 40% in many markets. If you owned a home, your net worth jumped. If you were trying to buy your first home, the down payment you'd been saving for just got further away, and your savings were losing purchasing power at the same time. Their 3% 30-year mortgage suddenly looked like a gift when inflation was running at 7 or 8%.
The distributional effects were all over the place. Some people got hammered, some people came out ahead, and it depended entirely on your specific mix of assets, debts, and labor market position.
That gap, 5 percentage points, is the biggest drop in real living standards since records began. People got raises and still fell behind. The race Daniel describes, where salaries either keep pace or real income shrinks? That race was lost, decisively, by millions of workers. Homeowners got a massive wealth transfer, effectively paid for by the erosion of everyone else's purchasing power.
We've got a system where inflation is structurally necessary, because of downward wage rigidity and the zero lower bound, but its effects are distributed in ways that feel random and unfair. The question becomes, what do we do about it? Daniel's instinct is to eliminate inflation. But if that's not feasible without risking deflationary spirals, what's the alternative?
Suddenly, the saver's penalty became structural. 2% inflation with near zero savings rates means guaranteed negative real returns.
That's a relatively recent phenomenon, right? For much of the 20th century, the ordinary saver wasn't getting punished this way.
If you look at the period from the 1950s through the early 2000s, there were certainly inflationary episodes where savers lost ground. The 1970s were brutal. But there were also long stretches where savings accounts and government bonds paid meaningful positive real returns. The post-2008 era broke that pattern. Central banks kept rates at emergency levels for essentially a decade, and even when they started normalizing, savings rates lagged well behind inflation. We normalized the idea that cash is guaranteed to lose value.
Daniel's question, wouldn't 0% inflation be better for ordinary savers, has a surface logic that's hard to argue with. If prices aren't rising, your savings hold their value. The prudent saver who just wants to put money aside and not think about it is structurally disadvantaged.
You can have zero inflation and stagnant wages. That's been Japan's reality for much of the past 30 years. Prices didn't rise, but paychecks didn't either. And if a recession hits when inflation is already at zero, the deflation risk we talked about becomes acute. Savers might keep their purchasing power for a while, right up until the economy contracts, jobs disappear, and the value of their savings becomes irrelevant because they need to spend them just to live.
The defense of the 2% target is essentially, yes, it quietly hurts savers in normal times, but it protects them from something much worse in bad times.
That's the argument. Whether you find it convincing depends partly on how you weigh those risks, and partly on whether you think there are better alternatives that haven't been tried. Every person in Norway is effectively a shareholder in a massive, globally diversified portfolio. The fund owns about 1.5% of all publicly traded companies worldwide. There's a real debate about this. Olivier Blanchard, the former chief economist of the IMF, has argued for raising the inflation target to 4%.
The Norwegian approach essentially acknowledges that inflation will happen, asset prices will rise with it, and the only way to make that fair is to give everyone a piece of the action. It decouples household financial health from the arbitrary distribution of inflation's effects.
And there are proposals to do something similar in the United States. Instead of saying inflation must be 2%, you say total nominal spending in the economy should grow at, say, 5%. If real growth is 3%, you get 2% inflation. If real growth is 1%, you get 4% inflation, which is fine under this framework because the spending trajectory is stable. The advantage is that it automatically accommodates supply shocks.
Another approach is wage indexation. If the problem is that wages don't keep up, why not tie the minimum wage and social security to productivity growth plus inflation, not just CPI? It's more flexible, but it's also harder to communicate to the public. We target 5% NGDP growth doesn't fit on a bumper sticker the way 2% inflation does.
And central banking runs on credibility and communication. The 2% target is simple, it's understood, and it's been internalized by markets for decades. Switching frameworks is risky. If markets don't trust the new target, you could get volatility that hurts everyone. Imagine trying to explain to the public that inflation is allowed to be 4% this year because growth was only 1%. It sounds like an excuse.
The deeper policy fix isn't zero inflation. It's universal asset ownership combined with wage indexation. Given all these trade-offs, what can an ordinary saver actually do about it?
This is the practical question, and I think there are three things worth keeping in mind. The first is the most basic. The best defense against inflation is not cash. It's diversified assets that historically outpace inflation. Equities, real estate, treasury inflation, protected securities, TIPS. Over long periods, a broad stock market index has returned something like 6-7% real after inflation.
Let's pull this together. Daniel asked whether inflation is a standard feature of a well-functioning economy, and whether we'd be better off targeting neutral inflation. TIPS are interesting because they're explicitly designed for this problem. The principle adjusts with CPI. Zero inflation isn't a stable equilibrium. It's a knife's edge with deflation on one side, and deflation is historically catastrophic. The 1920-21 recovery gets cited as a counterexample, but that economy had far less debt and a gold standard that functioned very differently.
The official number is a benchmark, not your reality. The measurement bias in CPI means true inflation is probably closer to 1 or 1.5% anyway, so we're not far from effective price stability. The target is a buffer, not a ceiling.
For individual savers, the actionable takeaway is that cash is a guaranteed loser over long horizons. The real risk isn't inflation, it's holding only cash. Diversification into TIPS, I-bonds, equities, and real estate isn't speculation. It's a practical hedge against a system that's designed to erode cash purchasing power. But that's an individual solution to a collective problem.
When someone proposes raising the target to 4%, you'll understand what's at stake. But we'd pair it with something like a universal inflation dividend, baby bonds, expanded sovereign wealth funds, automatic wage indexation tied to productivity. The goal isn't to stop the race between wages and prices. The answer, I think, is that we accept it because the people who designed it genuinely believe the alternatives are worse. Whether they're right is a live question. The Japanese experience with deflation is terrifying from a policy perspective.
That's the open question worth sitting with. Central banks have spent 30 years building consensus around the 2% target. They've largely succeeded. Inflation expectations are anchored. The deflationary spirals of the 1930s and Japan's lost decade haven't recurred. But the distributional question has been almost entirely neglected. There's also something almost philosophical here. Inflation is a tool for managing a growth-dependent economy. The whole system is built on the assumption that tomorrow will be bigger than today. More spending, more production, more consumption.
Digital currencies might change this calculus. Central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, would let central banks send money directly to citizens during crises. That's a much deeper conversation, but it connects to something real. The tension isn't going away. With central bank digital currencies being explored, with new monetary tools like helicopter money getting serious discussion, the inflation debate may look very different in 10 years.
The final thought is this. Inflation is a feature of a credit-based economy, not a bug. The race between wages and prices is real, and ordinary savers have legitimate grievances about how the system has treated them. Where does that leave us? If we redesign monetary policy from scratch tomorrow, would we still choose 2% inflation? Or is it a historical accident we're stuck with because changing it is too risky?
I think the honest answer is we'd probably pick something similar, but not identical. The 2% number itself has a bit of path dependence. It's stuck because it's stuck. But the principle of having a positive buffer against deflation is sound.
The net height at the center of a real tennis court is 3 feet, but the net drops to just 2 feet at the walls, an optical illusion that makes the court appear level when viewed from the Dadans, though the floor is actually slightly cambered. During the Cold War, the Simpson Desert's surface temperature was once recorded at nearly 70 degrees Celsius. But the handful of real tennis courts in Australia are all in coastal cities, none within 1,000 kilometers of that heat.
I have absolutely no idea what to do with that information.
And it's one Daniel's question rightly puts on the table. We're Korn and Herman Poppleberry, and we'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.